The Bob Murphy Show, episode 23.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. Today, it's another nerdy one. I have Peter Klein with me. By the way, I should mention on some of these things, sometimes I'm friends with the person and maybe I'm a little bit pugilistic, perhaps. And it's because I'm being, quote, funny. All right. So it occurred to me after I recorded this with Peter that if people didn't know that we knew each other and we kind of mess with each other on social media and whatever, that they might have thought, geez, Bob's being kind of tough with this guy. So just bear that in mind. Also, we didn't bend over backwards to give our respects to Israel Kirzner in this because I wanted to focus on the controversial stuff where Peter disagrees with some of Kirzner's, you know, signature work on entrepreneurship. But I mean, it should go without saying, but let me go ahead and say it right now. I mean, Israel Kirzner is an extremely important scholar in the Austrian tradition, real class act also. I mean, he's just a, you know, old school gentleman. And I studied under him at NYU. I took his class in the history of economic thought. And then, of course, he was at the Austrian colloquium. So, I mean, I think we were perfectly respectful in the interview, but I just wanted to say that at the outset, because again, I know sometimes people don't know the context and they hear something and don't know what the attitude is surrounding it. So I should probably just clarify that ahead of time to make sure nobody gets ruffled feathers. And also by me saying that, now you're going to have to listen to the episode, right? Like, oh, geez, what's Bob trying to preemptively apologize for? Let me hear. When's the juicy stuff happen? So normally with these episodes, and the same thing happens here, when it's somebody that's a familiar member of the Austrian school, we start out with their bio and their background. Same thing we do here. And then in the second half, we get into Peter's work. And so I would encourage you, we get into some pretty interesting stuff. And especially if you're a young budding Austrian economist, I think Peter and I, we bring up at least three or four things where we think the current state of Austrian economics has a lot of room for growth. Okay, so I mean, I'm saying it that way. I think Peter would agree with that, but I don't want to put words in his mouth. So anyway, this is not merely just teaching the basics here or just preaching to the choir. This is, we're laying some groundwork for new growth. So there you go. So for those who don't know him, let me just give a little bit of Peter's official biography. Peter G. Klein is W.W. Carruth Chair and Professor of Entrepreneurship at Baylor University and Senior Research Fellow with the Bauh Center for Entrepreneurship and Free Enterprise. He is also Adjunct Professor of Strategy and Management at the Norwegian School of Economics and Carl Menger Research Fellow at the Mises Institute. Peter has also held faculty positions at the University of Missouri's Division of Applied Social Sciences, the Copenhagen Business School, the University of Georgia's Terry College of Business, and Washington University's Olin Business School. He holds an honorary professorship at the Beijing University of Information Science and Technology. Peter received a PhD in economics from the University of California, Berkeley, and a BA from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His research focuses on the links between entrepreneurship, strategy, and organization, with application to innovation, diversification, vertical coordination, healthcare, and public policy. And his work, as you can imagine, has appeared in several journals. So without further ado, here is my interview with Peter Klein. Well, thanks, Peter, for joining me here on the Bob Murphy Show.
Bob, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
So as I always do, and Peter said before we began recording that he does at least listen to a few of these episodes, so he's become a better man for it. Peter, you know that for somebody like you that my audience is familiar with, we first start at the beginning. So how was it? At what point did you realize what I need to do with my life is to become an economics professor?
Well, my dad was an academic. He was a history professor. And so I knew a little bit about the life of an academic. And I know that I enjoyed that. I was a good student at school, enjoyed reading and writing and talking to people and arguing and so forth. But even at an early age, I I felt like I wanted some kind of a, you know, intellectual career. I use that word. I'm doing air quotes here. Mm-hmm. By intellectual, I mean somebody who deals with ideas and is involved in reading and writing and speaking and so forth. So I know I was sort of interested in that. When I was in high school, one of my classmates introduced me to Ayn Rand by giving me a copy of The Fountainhead. I'd never heard of Ayn Rand and had never really thought much about politics or economics or any of those things. My parents were kind of conventional left liberals. My dad idolized Franklin Roosevelt. And so, you know, I had pretty uninteresting middle of the road kind of views on those sorts of issues. But reading Ayn Rand, you know, if any of your other listeners had the experience of reading Rand as a teenager, you know, it was a real eye opener for me. And it introduced me to sort of a worldview that I found very exciting. I began reading as much as I could about reading other books and articles that she had written. And as some of your readers may recall, one of her nonfiction books called Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal. Is it famous? Because it also has a couple of chapters by Alan Greenspan.
Sure, right.
At the back of that book, she had an appendix with suggestions for future reading. And there were references to several books by Mises, Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, which I'm sure I read. I probably went to the library to get a copy of Hazlitt based on that recommendation. It's interesting. If you look at that list, some of the other titles are more obscure. There was a book by Carl Snyder called Capitalism, the Creator, which I started reading and sort of never could finish. But I became interested in reading about free market economics and sort of libertarian political economy by being introduced through Ayn Rand. And as some of your younger readers may not appreciate, what a different experience that was back in the ancient pre-internet days, right? So this was in the early to mid 1980s. And, you know, you had to go to the library. Of course, fortunately, I lived in a university town and there was a good university library.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you for. So where did your dad teach? Where were you?
He taught at several different universities. He taught at some schools in New York. But then when I was in high school, he was at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And so I had access through the university to most of the books and things that I could want. And you could send off for things by mail. Back in that day, you know, the place where most of us got our recommended readings and our you know, bibliographic information was from the Laissez-Faire Books Catalog, which was a paper catalog that came in the mail. Roy Childs, I think, was the one who actually wrote a lot of the little blurbs about the books, though they were not signed. And so I had no idea who the main writers were and what were the new books and even classic books of interest in this field. But every month or whenever the new edition of the Laissez-Faire catalog came out and I'd subscribed somehow, you know, I would grab it from the mailbox and just sort of devour it page by page, circle the books that I was interested in. Of course, you couldn't download things for free back in that day, and I didn't have an unlimited budget for buying books. But I was very excited to sort of learn about and try to sort of immerse myself into this world. And there really,
yeah, I had the Laissez-Faire and the Liberty Fund catalog too, and I remember my Christmas presents transitioning from, you know, Transformers toys to then getting Mises' Socialism or whatever for Christmas. And I was like, oh, I can't wait to read this thing.
Yeah, I mean, what kid doesn't find Mises' Socialism under the Christmas tree? But yeah, I had that same kind of experience. There were some other newsletters that I was aware of. I didn't know at that point any of the periodicals that Murray Rothbard was producing. And I'm not even sure which ones were still in publication at that time, Libertarian Forum and so forth. But there were several periodicals or newsletters, magazines that were put out by people in the Ayn Rand orbit. I remember one called The Intellectual Activist, which I subscribed to a bunch of these and I would read them when they came in sort of through my undergraduate college years as well. So it was, you know, it's like drinking from a fire hose. All of this information was I was sort of sucking it all up, and not in a very sophisticated or discriminating manner, but it really just opened my eyes to a new way of thinking about the world. And I've sort of never looked back from that experience.
Do you remember at what point you actually interacted with physical people in terms of, because that, you're right, the thing people really just, you can't even imagine before the internet how you could be a fan. I mean, first I was on another one, Peter, I mentioned that for the longest time I thought his name was Ludwig von Mises.
Right.
You know, just because how would I know? It's not like anybody else I talked to had heard of the guy. And so do you remember at what point you actually met other people who had read, you know, Economics in One Lesson and things like that?
Yeah, it was much, much later. So I went to college at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and I made a lot of friends, met a lot of bright students. I ended up majoring in economics because of my side. You know, by this point, I was reading Man, Economy, and State. I discovered Rothbard and reading Mises and so forth. And I decided to major in economics because I enjoyed the field of economics. I didn't really love all of my economics courses in college, but I thought that was something I could do. But I didn't meet any other sort of free marketeers until I started my PhD program. Actually, the summer before I started my PhD work at UC Berkeley, I had been invited to my first Mises Institute event. That was the summer of 1988. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met, you know, Murray Rothbard and David Gordon and Roger Garrison and Hans Hoppe, as well as Lou Rockwell and many other and other PhD students, other people who were PhD students at that time. But that was my first experience to be sort of face to face with a room full of free marketeers, libertarians, Austrians, and so forth. I had some good professors in college who were, you know, intellectuals who sort of stimulated my thinking, but really no one who was very ideologically aligned with my own views. One of my favorite professors was William Darity. He goes by Sandy Darity, who is now at Duke. He was at UNC at that time, and he's become sort of infamous in the last, I don't know, 6 to 12 months in some of our circles as one of the most vocal defenders of Nancy Maclean's book, Democracy in Chains. But he's kind of a Marxist, quasi-Marxist guy, but he was a great teacher and he was fun to talk to. And he was really very supportive of me. I had him for two or three classes and he ended up being the advisor for my senior honors thesis. I think he appreciated the fact that I was interested in economics, I was interested in ideas, that I was reading things on my own, you know, that I wasn't required to read for class, even though he thought the substance of the books, he didn't really approve of the books that I was reading, but he was happy that I was reading anything. And he was very encouraged me to go to graduate school and so forth.
Well, just on that point, I've noticed, and I've said this before, I would much rather interact with and debate or talk to even a Marxist rather than like a Hillary Clinton supporter. You know, because the Marxist understands the current system is really screwed up and has some really, you know, out there views and everything and is a heterodox, broadly defined, whereas somebody who's a Hillary Clinton supporter, you know, is pretty conventional. And I don't think I'm going to learn too much from that person.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, he was sort of an outside the box thinker. And I had him for intermediate macro. I also had him for a course in economic development. And we never had a conventional textbook in any of those courses. In the macro course, he had us reading the general theory, you know, the original text of the general theory. Of course, I was secretly on the side reading Henry Hazlitt's, what is it called? Failure of the New Economics. Yeah. The book where Hazlitt sort of goes through the general theory chapter by chapter. So I would come into class each day armed with some objections that I'd stolen from Hazlitt that I could bring up in class. We read much of the first volume of Marx's Capital in this economic development course. And you know, I found that a heck of a lot more interesting than the sort of boring textbook that I had in my introductory course, in my intermediate micro course, and so forth. But to get back to your question, I think you would agree with this. Probably some of our listeners who also have teaching experience would agree. But you know, as a professor, I'm delighted to have a student challenge me, whether it's from a Marxist perspective or some other kind of economics perspective. I just enjoy having students who want to ask me questions other than, you know, is this going to be on the test?
Right, exactly. You know, what chapters are covered in the final? Yeah. Yeah. The best of all worlds is when they ask a really insightful question that you totally know the answer to, and then you can hit it out of the park. That's the best.
Yeah, that doesn't happen very often, but right. That has happened once or twice.
As opposed to like, huh? I know it was funny. I was given a PowerPoint presentation one time and I was sitting there making the point and I was looking, you know, there was like four different charts of bar graphs and I was pointing to one of them as an illustrative example. Like, so you see here that, you know, proven reserves are necessarily lower than some other concept of reserves. I can't remember what it was in terms of, oh, it was like oil and gas or something like that. And somebody in the back row raised their hand and said, well, then how come on the other bar graph there that you didn't point to, it's the opposite? And I looked up and like I had been using this PowerPoint for years. And I just looked at that and I just said, I don't know. That's a good question. And, you know, then I had to go and find the person who made the graph and try to, you know, figure out what the deal was. But yeah, it was, I could have just bluffed my way through it, but I said, you know what? I'm just going to admit that, yeah, you got me. I don't know why it's like that.
You know, as they say, if you want to learn a subject, try to teach it to someone else.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So incidentally, when I was prepping for this, I read something that you said. Was it for this opening Mises Fellowship that you actually had a phone call with Rothbard?
Yeah, that's right. So I may not get the timing exactly right, but before I applied to my PhD programs, once I decided I wanted to pursue a PhD in economics, you know, I sent out applications for lots of programs, and I had come across, really completely by accident, an advertisement. I think it was a flyer on a bulletin board somewhere around the University of Tennessee that advertised Mises Institute graduate fellowships available. And I that was the first time I was aware that there was a Mises Institute. And of course, I was delighted and sort of and really amazed that someone had created an institute and named it after Mises, who I thought was one of the greatest, you know, economists, but not a mainstream or establishment, you know, kind of figure. And so I applied for that Mises Institute fellowship. And I guess I knew that Murray Rothbard was associated with the Mises Institute at that time, though I'm not exactly sure. But I remember getting a letter from Lou Rockwell, the president of the Institute, saying, you know, we've received your application. You know, we're interested in, you know, pursuing your application further. You know, as a next step, we would like you to have a phone call with our, you know, vice president for academic affairs, Murray Rothbard. Here's how to set it up. And of course, I, you know, nearly fell out of my chair upon reading that line mm-hmm. in the letter, because I had read lots of things by Rothbard, and I was completely, you know, gaga over the notion of getting to talk to him on the phone, and terrified as well.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to ask you. So this wasn't, he wasn't screening. This wasn't a conversation to see if you were in, you knew you were in, and this was just to help them get ready for you and for you to prepare?
Oh, no. I think this was part of the screen. Maybe. Look, I'd like to think that my application on paper was just so, it just dazzled the fellowship committee that it was just a formality at this point. But no, it was presented to me as the next step of the interview process to decide if you get it or not. Mm-hmm. You know, you will have a conversation with Murray Rothbard. So I was terrified that it might be a very, you know, he might be grilling me over something and then I would fail the interview. It turned
what
out
did Hayek mean by the secondary deflation process?
Yeah. Exactly. It turned out that it was a wonderful conversation. He was very friendly. He was warm. Now, again, for your younger listeners, remember, this is the era where there was no YouTube. So, you know, I'd seen his words in his books and articles, but I'd never seen him in person. I'd never heard a recording. So I had no idea what he would be like. You know, so I'm expecting maybe some kind of stern, very formal sounding guy. And of course, he was completely the opposite. Friendly, charming, you know, telling jokes, laughing. He had this very strong New York accent. Now, my father was a born and bred New Yorker from the Bronx. So from him and from my relatives, I knew what a New York accent sounded like. But Murray's cadence and his delivery and just his manner of speaking, of course, was still quite different from that of almost any other academic. But, you know, I don't remember everything that we talked about, but I remember that the conversation went well. And even though my heart was pounding, you know, he tried to put me at ease. And I think after that phone call, I was pretty confident that I was going to get the scholarship, and I did end up getting it. And that, you know, it had an impact on my choice of where to go to graduate school.
Okay, well, all right, that's great. Yeah, that's when I saw that, I was thinking, man, that would be intimidating to have what you thought was going to be a pretty you know, formal cross examination by Rothbard over the phone to see if you got in. But as you say, that wasn't. Yeah, I remember just briefly that when I was at NYU, and then I was reading antiwar.com. So this was 90 98, or I mean, it could have been calendar 99, but it was the 98, 99 academic year. And I was reading antiwar.com, and then Justin Romando mentioned that lewrockwell.com was going to launch. And so I started reading that. And then that's how I learned about the Mises Institute. And I had spent the first summer just doing temp work in New York City, like being a secretary for places because I could type really fast. You know, I could put on a shirt and tie and show up. And that was fine. You know, I had no problem with that. But then I went to the Mises Institute for my second year. And I thought I was going to be like, you know, getting coffee for Lou Rockwell or something. And I was very happy to do that. And I was amazed when I got down there and they're like, yeah, so what are you going to work on? You know, and I was like, wait, you're going to have me come and I get to do my research. I was kind of amazed by that. So you end up going to Berkeley. So, you know, I won't go through the obvious pot shots or whatever, but can you explain, like, did you apply? I mean, because that, of course, has a reputation as not being a hotbed of free market, limited government thinking. So did you apply to other more like saltwater schools and things and freshwater schools, I meant to say, as opposed to Berkeley? Or was that just, go ahead, just tell the story of that.
I knew enough from talking to my dad and from other people. And my dad helped me connect to some friends that he knew that were in the economics profession, you know, just sort of find out how it all worked. So I kind of understood the game to the extent that I knew that on the academic job market, it's very difficult to get a job at a university that's ranked higher than the university from which you graduated. So I knew I wanted a PhD from a high-ranking institution to have more job market options. Mm-hmm. But I applied, and I also knew that it was smart to apply to quite a few different schools. I can't remember now if I applied to, you know, it was more than six and less than 12, but I did quite a few applications, and I didn't get into every school that I applied to, but Berkeley was the highest ranked of the schools that did offer me admission and some kind of financial, you know, some kind of financial support. I certainly applied to NYU because at that time, NYU really had the only sort of Austrian program. Israel Kirzner and Mario Rizzo were on the faculty at that time. I believe Larry White, either Jerry O'Driscoll or Larry White, was also at NYU at that time. And as part of my application to NYU, I also ended up having a telephone interview with Israel Kirzner, which was a great thrill as well. But as I recall, that was later, a little bit later in the process. I think I had applied for admission to NYU and been accepted into the program. And Mario Rizzo was in charge of recruiting the PhD students, I guess, who would be connected to the Austrian program. I'd had a couple of conversations with Mario, and I think I had even visited the NYU campus and, you know, had an in-person interview with Mario. And I believe when I spoke to Kirzner over the phone, it was after they'd already offered me a spot in the class. And I don't want to make this sound better than it really was, but like, Kirzner was encouraging me to enter the program, telling me why it would be a good thing. And I remember we had a great conversation. You know, he has a very different personality from Rothbard, more formal and more serious, but very friendly and very encouraging. And what I had decided at that time, and I'm almost embarrassed to say, I may have said this directly to Mario or even to Israel, that my goal would be not to be your student at NYU, but to be your colleague, right? I'd like to be a professor at NYU, so I better go to get my PhD from someplace better than NYU. I mean, I hope I didn't say it directly like that, because that would be really inappropriate for, you know, some young punk who doesn't know anything and hasn't done anything. But I really was thinking that, thinking along those lines. I had also applied to Duke because they had and continue to have a very strong program in the history of economic thought. And I guess I was savvy enough to realize at that point that if I wanted to do research, you know, in the Austrian tradition, there were going to be some challenges doing that at a conventional economics program. And so I thought that maybe doing something specializing in the history of economic thought at a place like Duke would be a viable option. But I ultimately decided that my job market prospects would be the strongest if I went to Berkeley rather than one of these other schools. So I didn't.
So at that point, Berkeley was definitely better. The economics program was higher ranked than NYU's.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Because it's, I know NYU, I don't know if this was on your radar, but they made a bunch of hires. And I don't know if it's because you know, they had friends in the administration, but in the 2000s, they started making a bunch of hires. Like, I think they got Thomas Sargent at least for a while and stuff like that. So they really, right, their ranking went way up.
This was well before that time. Yeah. And NYU was a very, you know, was a good program, but it wasn't a top 20 kind of program.
Yeah. Can I tell you my joke? My joke
is, this is your show.
Yes. When I was at NYU, it was a top 20 program. And then after I left, it became a top 10. Or maybe top 15, but that's my joke.
Correlation does not always imply causality, but sometimes it does.
Okay, so you're at Berkeley, and then the quick, you know, name dropping there is, I know you interacted with Christina Romer, who was the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors in Obama's first administration.
Yes.
And she was a co-author.
Was it his first? Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. So that was much
absolutely
late.
Because she and Jared Bernstein were the two names on that infamous stimulus report.
Yeah. You know,
projecting
on
what happened with unemployment. So yeah, it was definitely the first. I couldn't remember if it was the chair of the CEA, but so what, do you have any stories about, like, so what was your role? Cause I know you were like, what, her TA or something?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So let me just back up a little bit. Okay. When I there's an important part of that story that I need to clarify. My story of why I ended up going out there. It wasn't as crazy or as opportunistic as it might sound. I don't want to leave our listeners.
Because it sounded pretty opportunistic.
Yeah, I didn't want to leave our listeners with the impression that it was a purely mercenary kind of a move, because at that time in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the Mises Institute had its administrative headquarters in the San Francisco area in a town called Burlingame, which is right by San Francisco Airport on the peninsula. So
I associate San Francisco with Austrian economics.
Yeah. So, you know, I had been in correspondence with the Mises Institute over this fellowship application.
Yeah.
And so Lou Rockwell was, I mean, his office was there in the San Francisco area, along with several of the other staff members. The Mises Institute also had an academic office at Auburn University, but the administrative office was in the Bay Area. And the first Mises Institute summer conference I attended before I started my graduate work was at Stanford. And so I guess my point is, I wasn't completely isolated out in the San Francisco area. So when I received the fellowship with the Mises Institute, one of the conditions was that I provide some services as sort of an intern in their office. So I would, you know, I'd be in my classes most of the week, but then every Friday afternoon, I guess, I would drive down to the Mises Institute, and I would spend one afternoon a week or more hanging out with a bunch of free marketeers at the Mises Institute while I was in my classes at Berkeley during the day. So I really did, I wouldn't say I led two lives, but I mean, I had my, you know, I've got to pass all my exams and pass my classes and satisfy my professors at Berkeley. I wore that hat some of the time, but I was also free to explore Austrian stuff in my other role. And of course, to meet a lot of great Austrian economists at Mises events and conferences and so forth. So again, because this was the pre-internet era, I couldn't, you know, lots of people now, lots of students are, you know, doing their schoolwork, but then they're doing Austrian stuff or whatever on the side on the internet. You could also do that in my day, but only in a few places where you could actually congregate with other Austrians or free market people. And the San Francisco area was one of them. I should mention also that the Independent Institute was in that area in Oakland. I got to know Thoreau and some of the Independent Institute personnel. Also, I had a very fortuitous sort of providential bit of good fortune that the summer after my first year at Berkeley. So as I recall, the way the funding model worked is we got some financial support sort of during the academic year, but not in the summer. You had to scrounge around for extra work to do teaching or RA work in the summer. And I didn't have anything lined up that first summer at Berkeley, but I had met Williamson Evers, who is at the Hoover Institution, was then at Hoover, and I think is still now at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. I'd met Bill through some Mises conferences, and I called him up and said, hey, do you know anybody at Hoover who might want to hire a research assistant? And he ended up putting me in touch with W.W. Bartley III, or Bill Bartley, as he was called. Bartley was an important philosopher. He was a student and disciple of Karl Popper, and Bartley was quite close to F.A. Hayek. In fact, Bartley at that time had been named the authorized biographer or the general editor of the collected works of F.A. Hayek being published by the University of Chicago Press. He was also connected to Hayek's estate. Hayek was still living at that time, but he was very close to Hayek, and he was kind of a de facto, he had control over Hayek's papers. He was organizing them and editing, supervising the production of Hayek's collected works, and was also writing a biography of Hayek at that time. And I was hooked up with Bartley. I had an interview with him and was hired by Bill Bartley to be his assistant that summer. So I was helping him with what eventually became volume 3 of the collected works of Hayek called The Trend of Economic Thinking. That's the title of that third volume. I was sort of the RA for volume 3 of the Hayek collected works. Then after that first year...
Can I stop you for a second?
You certainly can.
So I've heard people wonder, like they think some of Hayek's later writing seems like it changed, and I've seen people say like, oh, maybe Bartley, you know, had a lot more to do with this or something. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah, especially with Hayek's book, The Fatal Conceit.
Yes, right.
Which was Hayek's last, you know, sort of original work, and it was published, the way they did is they published The Fatal Conceit as volume 1 of the collected work, sort of a new book, and then all the subsequent volumes would be reprints of existing works or unpublished, you know, previously unpublished works. But there's been a lot of claims have been made that, you know, Hayek had drafted much of the material for The Fatal Conceit, but, you know, there's sort of a range of opinions here, either the final sequencing and structure of the book, or according to some critics, a lot of the content was actually written by Bartley rather than Hayek. I have no inside information on that. I mean, that project was already completed by the time I started. That book had already come out. And yeah, I mean, I know from working on some of Hayek's manuscripts, I'll get to that in a moment, that a lot of the sort of unpublished materials and notes that Hayek left were really kind of a mess. I mean, it took a skilled editor to piece together a lot of Hayek's materials into sort of a coherent form, but I really can't comment on the extent to which Bartley may have modified or edited or revised those manuscripts in a way that it fundamentally changed the meaning. I mean, I don't have any evidence that Bartley did this, but I have not inspected those archives as closely as some of the people who are really into that particular issue.
Okay, yeah, I just thought I'd ask since I know that's a controversy floating around.
Well, there's a sort of an important follow-up to this is that Bartley, he unfortunately passed away from cancer shortly after that volume 3 where I was the research assistant had been published. And his successor as general editor of the collected works was a guy named Stephen Kresge, who was had worked on the project before, but was really a little bit not really prepared to take on such a formidable task. And I remember Stephen Kresge said to me, "Well, the next volume." I have to back up a little bit. I think the after volume 3 was completed, before Bartley passed away, he had planned for the next volume in the series, volume 4, to be a collection of Hayek's writings on the Austrian school. And because I was a PhD student in economics and was, you know, starting to become fairly well-versed in the Austrian tradition, I remember Bartley asked me if I would be interested in serving as co-editor, a step up from research assistant, right, on volume 4. And of course I said, oh yeah, gosh, that sounds great. But I don't think we had ever sort of formalized that. Mm-hmm. He just kind of floated it as an idea. Well, after Bartley passed away, the publishers were anxious to get going on volume 4. And so I was asked to take on the role of editor of volume 4 of the collected works. Now, at this point, I had published absolutely zero mm-hmm. in my academic career, except what even today may be one of my most read publications ever, a letter to the editor in Sports Illustrated magazine. But you know, I didn't have any skill or knowledge or capability of editing something like that, but there was nobody else who could sort of do it on short notice. And because I already was involved with the project and I had access to the documents and I kind of knew what was expected, I ended up taking on that task. And I was very delighted to do that. And even now, a lot of people who have heard of me or people who talk to me at conferences, oh, aren't you the guy who, you know, was an editor on that Hayek book? I was very happy with the way the book came out. But I remember an odd conversation I had with another professor at Berkeley a few years later when I was finishing my PhD and going on the job market. And I said, well, how do I list this on my CV? I mean, it's very unusual for a PhD student to be editor of a collection of essays, you know, from a Nobel Prize winner, you know, published by a major publishing house. People are going to think I made that up, or you know, how do I handle that? And the guy was, he was very, you know, he said, no, you definitely need to put that on your CV. It's not the norm, but it's not going to be a bad signal. In fact, that's pretty impressive. How many people have edited a book, you know, of that type before they came out of, before they finished their PhD program. So the reason I brought that story up, Bob, is because, you know, I was not as isolated at Berkeley intellectually, right, and even socially as one might expect. I had the group Bartley and Stephen Kresge and another editor, a wonderful woman named Jean Opton, who were also involved in that project and all living there in Oakland, California, close to Berkeley. I had Lou and the rest of the Mises Institute administrative staff on the peninsula just south of San Francisco and me at Berkeley. So I was in physical contact with lots of friendly, you know, fellow travelers, as well as being, you know, sort of stuck with the Berkeley folks who had very different views on things. So it wasn't exactly the way.
Right. I'm glad you did clarify, because it did. I mean, not that I would have held it against you, but yeah, it did sound originally like you just made the decision purely in terms of the top ranked school. Now, my role as interviewer, I would be remiss if I didn't ask the obvious follow up. What was the content of your letter to the editor of Sports Illustrated? Were you saying there should be 2 swimsuit issues per year, or?
That would have been a good topic to write on. But no, the topic was actually the renovation of old sporting arenas. So when I was a student at UNC, I think it was in 1986, they replaced their old kind of intimate gymnasium, the place where Michael Jordan had played and so forth, with a new modern, what was at that time a state-of-the-art 20,000-seat arena, which is now the Dean Smith Center, where the UNC Tar Heels still play their basketball games. And a lot of people, a lot of the old-timers complain. They say, well, it's not as loud, and it's too corporate, and it doesn't have that same intimate feel as those little, you know, sort of cozy, old-fashioned arenas. You know, Duke's Cameron Indoor Stadium is one of the last of the remaining kind of old-fashioned gymnasiums in sort of a major program. But I wrote a letter, and I'm actually quite proud of this. It's using economic reasoning, basically saying, yeah, that's fine for you, Mr. Sports Illustrated sports writer, who can get into any game anywhere and get a great seat no matter what. But there are a lot of, you know, poor schlubs like me, mm-hmm, who couldn't get into the games at the smaller intimate arena, who now can get into the games at the larger, you know, less friendly kind of places. So there's sort of a trade-off there. And it, you know, it's like rent control, or if you already have a nice apartment, rent controlled apartment, rent control is good for you, but it's not good for the, you know, the forgotten man or the unseen, as, you know, Bastiat or Hazlitt would have put it. And I was making the argument that, the sports writer who was complaining was not thinking about all of the folks who now could see games who couldn't see them before. That's actually not a bad argument for a 19-year-old or whatever to have made.
Yeah, I remember one of my proudest things, and like you said, perhaps the most widely read, at least before the internet for sure, was there had been a plane crash, and somebody, you know, some op-ed writer said, you know, wacko libertarians are all for cutting budgets, but in the wake of, it was when the value jet went down in Florida. Do you remember that? And it was like,
It was that,
you know, that was the news hook. And then, so somebody, you know, one of the national op-ed writers at that time said, you know, wacko libertarians want to cut budgets, but the rest of us want the FAA to get more funding. And so I wrote, it started out as a letter to the editor, and then they told me to write more, and they expanded it. And it was a full page, not a full page, but like a half page essay you know, on the opinion section in the back of my newspaper. And I lived in a big, you know, it was a big distribution. And, you know, and I think I was in high school. And it was a bit, you know, it was a big, and I was, of course, calling for a completely free market. And I was pointing out, okay, so when the FAA screws up and there's a plane crash, they're going to get more funding according to this model. And right. Does that really sound like a good system? You know, that kind of thing.
Hey, Bob, so, we were child prodigies. I mean, what happened to us?
I know. Okay, so now you're at Berkeley, and give us something. Give us some red meat about Christina Romer.
Before I get to Christina Romer, let me just say in general, you know, remember, this was a period, late 80s, early 90s, when economics was sort of continuing its march towards a more kind of rigid, conforming, kind of standardized model. So, you know, a lot of people hear, you hear the word Berkeley, you think of, you know, crazy Marxists and so forth. Well, there were crazy Marxists and hippies and other sorts of people in the town, but really not on campus. The economics department was very, you know, mainstream. When I started, there were one or two kind of old-fashioned heterodox economists still around. There was a very famous Marxist economist called Benjamin Ward, but he must have been in his 70s by the time I got to Berkeley. He retired and was not replaced with someone like that. So all of the professors that I had were kind of what you would call mainstream, mostly sort of MIT or Harvard-trained economists. So the sort of MIT model had diffused very widely throughout the profession by that time. And even, you know, within a few years, or I guess around the time I was a PhD student shortly after, even at places like Chicago, Minnesota, UCLA, and so forth, Rochester, even the sort of Chicago model kind of died off. I mean, nowadays there really isn't a Chicago school, or there's not any kind of dominant alternative to the kind of, I don't know what you would call it, neoliberal, neo-Keynesian, new Keynesian kind of consensus. So the my micro classes were all standard Aero de Brew kind of, you know, formal mathematical economics. For macro, I had a lot of the what was then being starting to be called the new Keynesian school. So I actually had George Akerlof, who is better known as a microeconomist for his famous Market for Lemons paper. I had him in a macroeconomics class where he was teaching about back then these sort of sticky wage models, implicit contract models, efficiency wage models that were more kind of sophisticated ways of sort of coming up with the same kind of traditional Keynesian conclusions that both monetary and fiscal stimulus was necessary to stabilize the economy. But unlike the old Keynesians, who operated at a very high level of aggregation and sort of ignored the more micro level kind of incentive effects and so forth, the new Keynesians responded to the critique of people like Lucas and Sargent, who said, oh, well, Keynesian economics doesn't have any micro foundations, by building new micro foundations for Keynesian style macro policies, conclusions, results, and so forth. So that's the tradition in which I was being trained. I did have a course in economic history from Christina Romer, and I liked that course a lot. That course was actually co-taught by Christina Romer and Barry Eichengreen, who is also a very well-known kind of, you know, Keynesian style. Yeah.
Not a fan of the gold standard, I would say.
Not a fan of the gold standard, yeah. Although I funny story, I did a term paper for Eichengreen's part of the course on free banking. It was basically a sort of a book report on Larry White's book, Free Banking in Britain, which I guess was maybe only 2 or 3 years old at that point. And as I recall, and I've told this to Larry White, Eichengreen quite liked my book report, which was sort of a bland summary of Larry's arguments, and said, oh, I really need to read that book. But I don't
yet more evidence very much against the free bankers.
By the White-Selgin sort of school of thought.
I bet the Marxists liked it too. Am I right? I'm just kidding, folks. Come on, lighten up here. He's talking about Aero de Brew models. I got to do something.
Yeah, that's a good point.
By the way, incidentally, it's just a real quick thing. I know this is, but just for people who don't know these terms. So economic history is not the same as the history of economic thought.
Correct. And Berkeley did not have any required courses, and as I recall, not even any optional courses on the history of economic thought. There was this Eichengreen and Romer course on economic history. which is, you know, the application of modern economic tools to studying kind of the data of the past. It's a little bit of a joke. I ended up doing my PhD dissertation on sort of the experience of U.S. corporations in the 1960s. And I would sort of joke with people, well, is this economic history? I mean, how old do your data have to be to classify it as economic history rather than applied economics? You know, we Austrians consider analysis of the data of yesterday to be economic history, you know, sort of in a fundamental sense. But the mainstream economists certainly did not. Part of the reason that, you know, you asked about Christina Romer because she became well known as Obama's advisor, but a lot of Berkeley economists, a lot of my professors got into policy work actually earlier during the Clinton administration. So as you may recall, Clinton's first CEA chair was Laura Tyson, who was an international economics professor at Berkeley. And so through those sort of connections, a lot of Berkeley economists ended up taking positions in the Clinton administration. So I did a field sequence in industrial organization, and almost all of my IO professors did a rotation as, you know, chief economist at the Federal Communications Commission or chief economist at the, you know, at the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department. They were in and out of the Labor Department and the SEC and other kinds of governmental organizations. So there was a big pipeline between Berkeley and Washington, D.C. during both halves of the Clinton administration. And I think that's how people like Christina Romer ended up getting sort of connected to the kind of, you know, behind the scenes advisors, decision makers and power brokers and so forth within the Democratic Party, many of whom, it was the same people under Obama, many of the same people under Obama who had also performed those kinds of roles under Clinton.
Now, and were you on the CEA under Clinton?
So I was, but I have to clarify what that means. So, I
think you do need to clarify, yeah. Dr. Klein.
Clinton called, Peter, I really need your help to get this economy straightened out. No, it wasn't that. What happened is, so after I was already finished with my, I completed my graduate work and I had gotten my first academic position at the University of Georgia. And a friend of mine who had been a PhD student with me at Berkeley and specialized in economics and law, and later became a law professor. He had worked in a number of different positions in the Clinton administration, including the position of senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisors. And that must have been in the late 90s. And so he recommended me as a successor when he stepped down from that position in, I guess it would have been 1999 or around early 2000. He recommended me. Sorry, I'm getting confused on my years here. Yeah, that would have been early 2000 is when he was rotating off. He recommended me as his successor for this position of senior economist at the CEA. Now, people say, "Oh, you were on the council." I mean, technically, the Council of Economic Advisors is a very small organization. The Council of Economic Advisors is just three people. There's a chairman or a chair of the CEA, and then there are two other members of the council. The next level under that is the senior economists, who are typically, you know, professors, people with some training and experience, who do actual, you know, do most of the actual policy work. Then there are what they used to call junior economists. I think they're now just called economists at the next layer down, who are typically PhD students. And then there are RAs and interns and so forth. So I was not on the council, but I did receive an offer and accept an offer to do kind of a one-year stint in the 2000-2001 academic year as a senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisors with the portfolio of issues related to industrial organization, regulation, antitrust, technology, entrepreneurship, telecommunications, and so forth.
Let's take a break for a second in my conversation with Peter Klein to talk about Mises University. So this is a week-long event that's in Auburn, Alabama, and it's the flagship event of the Mises Institute. And Peter Klein is one of the lecturers, so am I. Tom Woods is frequently there, Joe Salerno, plenty of people that we've had here on the podcast. And so check it out. If you're an undergrad student in particular, they're looking for an application from you. go to bobmurphyshow.com/MU. So just to sum up then for the listeners here, Peter, what they've learned thus far about your background is in undergrad, the professor who took you under his wing was a Marxist. At grad school, you were a TA for Christina Romer, and then you served as a senior economist in the CEA under Bill Clinton.
Hey, exactly. You know,
okay. Just want to make sure.
Yeah. Think of the massive impact I have on the margin. Right? I wasn't able to change any of those people's opinions, but they were exposed to a point of view that they probably
you're going to reform from within. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously, I'm kidding. So then, I think probably why don't we jump into, because I know I don't have it for much longer here. Your own work. So what you're known for, of course, is your work on entrepreneurship.
Right.
So can you give us I don't know how you want to, but go ahead and give it an introductory thing, because I know this is what you've done, and you don't just elaborate on the stuff that's in Human Action. Like you've really done, you've pushed the boundaries here.
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, even though I got my PhD at Berkeley, but I had the pleasure of knowing and working with Murray Rothbard and the other Austrian school economists, even from my very beginning of my graduate school days. So I feel that all of my work is in the Austrian tradition. Although I don't always use the exact language that was used by Mises or Rothbard or even is used by all contemporary Austrians. My PhD advisor was Oliver Williamson, who is a very interesting example of a slightly heterodox economist in his own right. I mean, he was fairly traditionally trained and, well-established within the kind of mainstream of the industrial organization subfield of economics throughout most of his career.
Just to put him in a box, is he... He's considered like the Coase approach to the firm and stuff and law and economics. Is that kind of?
Yeah, so he's best known for his work on vertical integration, the so-called transaction cost approach to organizational structure of companies. Certainly very heavily influenced by Coase. A lot of his work is sort of fleshing out some of the ideas that were suggested by Coase many decades earlier. But he is a successful guy. Spent most of his career at the University of Pennsylvania. He was also at Yale Law School before he came to Berkeley. And he was very successful as a mentor of PhD students, mainly in the field of business economics. So my PhD is in economics, but most of Williamson's advisees were actually in the business school. And they positioned their research as something like a business strategy or corporate governance. But really, the issues were about what companies do, how companies are organized, antitrust issues related to corporate behavior and so forth. And so I positioned my dissertation as a Williamson-style study of how large companies grew and became more diversified across industries in the 1960s, what explained the rise of these sort of conglomerate corporations, and were they inefficient? Because a lot of criticism from, especially from strong proponents of antitrust, is that, these widely diversified companies are really, they're wasting resources and they're harming consumers and so forth, and they need to be split up by the antitrust authorities. And I sort of argued that that wasn't the case and that conglomerate mergers were not harmful as they had, the way it had been portrayed in some of the other literature. I mean, that was very much informed by the insights of the Austrians, framed within the kind of Williamson tradition. Now, so I was always interested in the connections between Austrian economics and issues related to companies, firms, businesses, entrepreneurs. In fact, some of my earliest publications were about sort of the connections between Austrian-style entrepreneurship and issues like, how large can firms get before things break down? Why do firms sometimes make their own inputs instead of buying them? I had a paper published in 1996 and then another one in, I think, 2001 in the old Review of Austrian Economics, exploring the relationship between the Austrian understanding of entrepreneurship and issues related to like corporate structure and corporate governance. But I didn't think of myself as an entrepreneurship scholar. I mean, I really wasn't even aware at that time that there was an academic field of entrepreneurship, you know, beyond what is described in the Austrian tradition, right? Mises, if you look up Human Action, just look at the index, right? Mises talks a lot about entrepreneurs in Human Action, but he's using the entrepreneur in a fairly abstract sense, right? Of the party responsible for making these decisions about how resources are allocated. I only discovered later, after I was already had been a professor for probably a decade or more, that there was a whole academic literature on entrepreneurship, but usually thinking of the entrepreneur in a more historically contingent way, you know, the study of people like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, people who start companies, people who grow companies, people who introduce new products and services to the market. And there's a lot of research trying to explain, you know, what kinds of individuals are likely to start companies and be successful at starting companies. How do different aspects of the legal system or the regulatory system make it easier or more difficult to start a company or to grow a small company or to get venture capital and that sort of thing. Once I discovered that academic field, I realized, hey, that's a much better, you know, that's really a venue in which I can apply the insights of the Austrian school to sort of new and exciting and interesting sort of phenomena that have a lot of contemporary relevance, right? Everybody now, you know, everybody knows who Steve Jobs is and kids want to be the next Steve Jobs or whatever. And everybody knows how important venture capital is and angel investment and business incubators and so forth. These are hot topics in academia, in among practitioners, among policymakers. And it turns out that Austrian economics is extremely useful and powerful in helping to shed new understanding, shed new light on those phenomena.
Can I stop you for a second? So there, I read something you wrote, and obviously correct me if I'm getting it wrong, but you said something along the lines of, oh yes, Kirzner's, you know, work in this area is extremely useful, but I would view it, you know, Peter Klein view it more as a contribution to micro rather than entrepreneurship studies or something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, but I think you've got it the other way around. What I think you're referring to is a paper that I wrote with Per Byland, where we argued that when Kirzner's very important book, Competition and Entrepreneurship, appeared in 1973, it was viewed by the Austrians as a major contribution to microeconomics, to the sort of understanding of how markets work. And I had that same view when I read the book, and as a PhD student, I thought, oh gosh, I'm just going to give copies of this to all my micro professors, and they'll realize immediately that kind of the mainstream Marshallian, Walrasian, equilibrium-based understanding of markets is incorrect. But it turns out, if you just look at like citation patterns, and even you think sort of more qualitatively about the direction of the economics profession, unfortunately, Kirzner's idea of entrepreneurial alertness and markets as process of discovery and so forth, that those ideas really haven't had any influence that I can discern on mainstream microeconomics, but they have been extremely influential in the entrepreneurship field. And just to sort of elaborate for your listeners, Kirzner had argued that the problem with the sort of conventional equilibrium models is that they assume that the market is already in equilibrium, or rather they characterize the properties of that equilibrium and they describe how the rest of the world would look, you know, when markets have these equilibrium properties. But they miss the fact that in reality, markets are not they're not in these equilibrium states. Prices are not at their equilibrium values. And you can't just assume that real markets are always tending towards equilibrium states, that real prices are always tending toward equilibrium values, unless you have some theory of sort of convergence to equilibrium. And Kirzner, in my understanding, he saw his contribution as providing such a theory of convergence. You know, the simple version is there's not a lot of $20 bills on the ground waiting to be picked up because, you know, people will tend to pick them up, right? Mm-hmm. The sort of neoclassical equilibrium view of that joke. Maybe you've told this joke on the show before. You know, the two economists walking down the street and one of them sees a $20 bill on the ground. He bends down to pick it up, and his fellow economist friend says, "What are you doing?" "Well, there's $20. I'm going to go grab it." And the other economist says, No, there's no $20 on the sidewalk. The first guy says, well, what do you mean? It's right there. Second one says, look, if there were a $20 bill on the sidewalk, somebody would have picked it up. And the first economist says, oh, yeah, you're right. And then they keep on walking. Mm-hmm. Right.
So yeah, on this podcast, we do more observational humor.
I like that version. The point of the joke is, if you believe that equilibrium obtains at all times, there cannot be any profit opportunities out there, because if there were, somebody would have already taken advantage of them. Kirshner said, no, that's not right. Kirshner said, there are some $20 bills on the sidewalk. There's not a lot of them. And a lot of people just sort of walk by without noticing them. But occasionally, you know, if you're more aware of your surroundings than other people, you may be able to find one and pick it up. So people who are more alert than other people will see $20 bills on the sidewalk. They won't be there for long. There's a tendency for them to get picked up, but it doesn't happen instantaneously. And the application to, you know, real markets is that, oh, well, if you look at an iPhone, right, before the iPhone was introduced in, what, 2006, 2007, you know, if someone else, if Steve Jobs hadn't realized that you could spend X dollars in R&D and for materials and labor and so forth to produce a device that you could sell for more than X dollars and earn a nice profit, you know, somebody else would have eventually figured that out. The reason that Apple was able to realize those profits, recognize and appropriate those profits, is because Apple recognized before anyone else that there was an opportunity in the market to combine resources into some output that you could sell for more than what it cost you to obtain the resources. So the profit that companies like Apple receive is a reward for superior alertness to a market opportunity that was out there that no one else had recognized could be filled. So that was sort of Kirshner's explanation for what markets are all about. What's interesting
I think just to, again, obviously, Peter, you and I could speak at a more technical, but I mean, just for the listener too, in case you've never heard this, I think what Kirshner did also was he was trying to say, and again, in his mind, he was just fleshing out what was already in Human Action and other pieces of Mises' output, was saying, you know, just a simple arbitrage, like, oh, the apples sell on this side of the street, you know, for $1 a pound, across the street for $1.50, you buy low, sell high, and then you would keep doing that until you'd whittled away, you know, you'd push up the prices on the left side and push them down on the right side until there was no more pure arbitrage available. And just saying that's what the entrepreneur does, except in terms of, oh, I can buy these factory, you know, I can buy this labor and, you know, this capital, the goods and these natural resources and mix them together and produce a product that sells for, you know, more than the input prices, including the cost of capital over time, blah, blah, blah. And that's what you do. So you're right. The only way that could persist is if everybody else missed it, and that's what the alert entrepreneur seizes that profit opportunity and seizes it. And then by doing so, destroys the profit opportunity because he bids up the prices of the inputs and pushes down the price of the output until the rate of return, all things considered, is the same in that line as anywhere else.
Exactly. In this framework, all profit is essentially arbitrage profit. In my story of the iPhone, it's kind of intertemporal arbitrage. And, you know, with day traders or people, you know, moving fruit or vegetables, you know, buying them in one farmer's market, selling them in another, it's sort of spatial arbitrage. But the idea is, yeah, the way you make money, the way you earn a profit is by recognizing and exploiting arbitrage opportunities before other people. And as you point out, the mere act of exploiting these opportunities makes them go away. Two comments on that. That argument has been extremely influential in the applied study of entrepreneurship, because my sense is the entrepreneurship field and, you know, has journals and conferences and research grants and academic positions and so forth in business schools, mainly in business schools, that profession had, you know, up until the 1970s and 80s, not had a lot of kind of rigorous academic foundations. It was a lot of, you know, sort of storytelling and anecdotal evidence and case studies of important entrepreneurs, but it lacked a kind of rigorous sort of theoretical foundation. And I think when people in that field discovered Kirshner, they said, ah, this is kind of the rigorous foundation we've been looking for. So the entrepreneurship scholars began to say, oh, well, what our field is really all about is the analysis of these profit opportunities or entrepreneurial opportunities that Israel Kirzner and his colleagues have theorized about. So we're sort of taking Kirzner's abstract theoretical framework and adding flesh and, you know, flesh and bone to it by saying, well, what types of individuals are more likely to be alert to arbitrage opportunities? What is the nature of these opportunities? Where do they come from? How quickly do they go away? What are the implications of certain people, but not other people, choosing to pursue these opportunities and not those opportunities? So it's really reconceptualizing the field around Kirzner's intellectual framework. Second point about Kirzner's idea is I think it's wrong. I think it's useful, but I think it is fundamentally not what entrepreneurship is. I think it's fundamentally the wrong way to think about how markets work. And I think it has unfortunately led part of the entrepreneurship field and also some strands of the Austrian tradition kind of in the wrong direction. And what I mean by that is the problem with the Kirznerian metaphor, and it's obvious if you think about it even for just a few moments, and Kirzner himself has written a lot about this aspect, right? It assumes that these arbitrage opportunities or opportunities for profit already exist in the world, just waiting for someone to come along and discover them, right? So the discovery metaphor, what does it mean to discover something? Well, you know, I don't know where my missing sock is, and I go into another room and I discover it sitting there on the floor. I didn't create the sock, right? Or at least as part of this analysis of my behavior, the sock already existed. The $20 bill was already on the ground. The only interesting analytical issue is whether or not you're going to pick it up. Problem with that is, well, where do these things sort of come from? Well, Kirzner recognizes this is not meant to be a literal description of how the social world operates. It's meant to be a useful metaphor for understanding economic profit. But I think there's a much better way of understanding economic profit. And that comes from introducing uncertainty into our analysis of action. And I should say that while, I mean, I Kirzner, as you pointed out, interprets his discovery framework as being sort of an elaboration of Mises, but I read Mises in a different way. Mises puts uncertainty really front and center of his analysis of human action. It's all sprinkled throughout Mises' writings that human behavior, human, you know, sort of rational, purposeful human behavior is about action in the face of uncertainty. The actor does not know for certain whether action will bring about the results that are desired. And profit in Mises' conceptualization, as I understand it, is sort of the reward you get when you were correct in your anticipation of what the future was going to be like. So let me go back to the $20 bill example with my preferred version of that story. You know, you're walking down the street, a couple guys are walking down the street, they see, you know, kind of a little green piece of paper, a little corner of a green piece of paper sticking out from under a large rock. And, you know, it might be a $20 bill, but it might be, you know, a chewing gum wrapper. And you really can't tell just by looking at it. The only way you can find out is by going to the hardware store, buying some kind of a tool, a shovel or a pick or something, using that tool to remove the stone, and then seeing if, in fact, it's a $20 bill. Now, let's say that that tool costs $10. And just to make the example simple, let's say you have to buy it outright. You can't rent it. And let's assume that your labor is costless and so forth.
Why don't they just assume a sledgehammer?
Assume it's a giant can opener. We can use that to lever the rock out of the way. But my point is, you spend the $10, then you go remove the rock. If in fact it is a $20 bill, then you have earned an economic profit of $10 because you have receipts in excess of your expenditures. But it might just be a chewing gum wrapper, in which case you've earned a $10 loss. So profit accrues to those who are better than other actors at anticipating what will come about in the uncertain future. One of the reasons I like this metaphor or this framework better than Kirzner's is that it provides kind of a symmetric treatment of both profit and loss. Problem with Kirzner's metaphor is that there can never be any economic losses, right? The worst that can happen to a decision maker in Kirzner's framework is you fail to recognize an opportunity that you might have recognized and you break even, right? The worst that can happen to you is zero. But of course, in the business world, companies, individuals make money, lose money all the time. And there's really no way to incorporate loss into Kirchner's framework in a way that is straightforward and makes a lot of sense. So to make a long story short, my Misesian understanding of entrepreneurship is that entrepreneurship is action under uncertainty. And those who are better at exercising what Mises called judgment about the uncertain future earn economic profits. And those who are less successful than others at exercising judgment about the uncertain future earn economic losses.
Yeah, I like that. And it's funny because I remember my own thinking on this. At first, you know, reading Kirchner's stuff, it just seems like an elaboration. Oh, yeah, of course. That's was in Mises. And it is. In other words, you could point to passages of Mises that seems like it totally leads right into what Kirchner's treatment was. But you're right. That issue of the possibility of entrepreneurial loss or error, it's sort of like, okay, so if you're going to explain profits by entrepreneurial alertness, then do you explain losses by entrepreneurial, you know, sluggishness or obtuseness? You know, and yet that's not, you know, and obviously you could say, you know, I guess I've never heard what Kirchner's response to that particular point. I guess he could say, well, sure. He must be positing there's like a baseline level of alertness, and then the people who have above average are the one that earn profits, and the people who have below average earn losses. But that seems like you're changing. It's like you're saying, it's no longer alertness to opportunity. It's something else entirely.
Exactly right. I mean, what Kirchner, of course, he recognizes this problem. Kirchner, he uses the term, he says, well, sometimes discovery can be mistaken. Well, I think, well, then by definition, it's not discovery, right? Then it's, yes, you thought there was something there and it turns out you were wrong, i.e. at the moment of action, you did not know whether the gain, whether the opportunity was there to be exploited or not. Therefore, that's just another way, and in my mind, a kind of awkward and confusing way to say, yeah, you're acting under uncertainty. You're pursuing what you anticipate will be, what you hope will be, what you expect will be, some kind of material or other kind of gain, but you fully recognize at the time of action that you might be wrong and the gain might end up being a loss.
That's another curveball I'll just throw in this thing too, is I think there is, you know, the distinction between risk and uncertainty is relevant here. And I think standard Austrian canonical treatments don't handle that very well. So for example, a hedge fund that's really levered and happens to have, you know, oh, wow, we outperform by 30% over the S&P or something. There's a sense in which, so they anticipated the future better. You know, the stocks, the portfolios they had and the particular things they did were better and they served the consumers better. But there's also a sense in which you want to say, yeah, but they just got lucky. If they kept doing that, it's going to blow up.
Right.
Or another example I used in a thing I did for a Liberty Fund conference on this was imagine a guy who has a t-shirt company and he's located in like a football town, you know, a big Auburn or something where they have big football games and the big rival teams coming into town and the owner has to go away on business and he leaves like the local college student kid in charge of the thing. And normally what they do is they print up half and half, you know, in other words, so right. No matter who wins, they have enough t-shirts to sell in the parking lot after the game. And then, but the kid's really sure the home team's going to win. So he just does the whole print run, assuming that the home team's going to win. And if it turns out and they're right and they do win, then of course the boss comes back or the owner and the kid has much more profit to show for it because he didn't waste, you know, on a half run of t-shirts that now he can't sell or you got to sell for rags. But you can imagine the owner, you know, so there's a sense in which, oh yes, you did what the consumers wanted. You put the cotton and the labor and electricity and the ink for the t-shirts into those resources that the consumers wanted better than others did. But there's also a sense in which the owner would be furious and say, don't you ever do that again. If the other team had won, you know, we would have lost thousands of dollars on that print run. What are you thinking, you idiot? You got lucky.
Right.
So you know, that those sorts of things, I think, show that the conventional, like even in Man, Economy, and State or whatever, there's that distinction. And I think what it is, the distinction between what was called, you know, risk and uncertainty comes up there as well.
Well, there are a couple things on that. I mean, you're right that a lot of some of the Austrian literature, I think, has not been as careful as it should be about making that kind of distinction. But then again, I find a lot of the contemporary Austrian literature to be very loosey-goosey on the concept of equilibrium. And, you know, Joe Salerno has written about this. I've written about it as well, that if you look carefully at Austrians from Menger to Mises, Rothbard, and beyond, you find very different and precisely used equilibrium constructs. But when I read a lot of the contemporary Austrian literature, it's equilibrium this, equilibrium that. Is there convergence to equilibrium, yes or no? Well, it depends what kind of equilibrium you're talking about. To go back to your specific question, Mises does not, refer to the distinction popularized by Frank Knight between risk and uncertainty, but he does use the distinction expounded by his brother, younger brother, Richard von Mises, on case probability versus class probability, mm-hmm. class probability being more like Knightian risk, mm-hmm. case probability being more like Knightian uncertainty. But you're right. What I'm talking about when I say uncertainty is not just dice rolls, right? And it's not something that you can fully diversify. It's a sort of deep, fundamental, ontological uncertainty. Our lack of, you know, we don't know, we can't write down a probability distribution function and just optimize according to our risk return preferences, right? There really is a much more deep and sort of fundamental qualitative uncertainty about you know, how things work. Now, that doesn't mean we have no knowledge about what the future, you know, is likely to be. And I think one of the reasons that a lot of mainstream economists struggle with this is because, you know, in their view, there are two kinds of behavior, right? There's rational behavior and there's, you know, random behavior. Right, you can either optimize, you know, you maximize utility function or whatever, you optimize versus given some objective function and behave rationally or, you know, irrationally in a biased fashion, or you just do blind guessing, but there's nothing in between. There's no notion of kind of intuitive gut instinct decision making that is not purely random, but nor is it, you know, rational in the sort of formal sense. And I think Mises really does have in mind that there's this kind of middle ground. Mises uses terms like Verstehen, the German word that we usually translate as understanding. Mises talks about entrepreneurs having a, he calls it a specific anticipative understanding of the uncertain future. That's great, you know, Misesian English, right? Not the way most of us talk at a cocktail party.
Right. But most people say, oh, you mean Verstehen. Yeah. That's what he means. Yeah.
What he means is the entrepreneur is, you know, it's not blind guessing. The entrepreneur does have this kind of sort of deep knowledge, industry-specific, contextual knowledge about what is likely to happen in the future, but is not predicting using sort of a formal decision model. It's the same notion that Mises uses in his discussion of what we do as analysts in engaging in economic history, right? So this, Mises has this funky word, thymology, that he uses to describe the study of economic history, where, yeah, you have some tools and techniques, you might use some math and statistics, but you all, ultimately, the historian has got to apply some kind of subjective interpretation of the data to know how to weight things and what factors are really more important or less important, how to frame the question and so forth. Well, that's really the same thing, according to Mises, that the entrepreneur does sort of in a forward-looking direction. But because mainstream economists cannot incorporate something like thymology or interpretation or understanding into their model, they say, oh, well, if some individuals make more money than others, or some firms earn more profit than others, you know, it's either some kind of structural factor, you know, monopoly power or whatever, or it's just luck, it's just randomness. They can't incorporate sort of anything in between, which is why they have a very difficult time understanding Mises' arguments.
Yeah, so on this, and I know, Peter, your point wasn't to denigrate the work of Kirzner or anything, but let me just, in fairness to him too on this. So the way mainstream economists handle, so originally, let me back up. Originally, for the folks at home here, mainstream, what we might call neoclassical models, you know, mathematical models of, oh, there's an agent that has a utility function and there's production, there's firms with production. They were certain, like, the, you know, the future was known, deterministic and so forth. You would, the agent would optimize and everything was boom and everything would just unfold. It was like the, it was like a clockwork model of the universe in, you know, in terms of Newtonian mechanics or something in the old conception and everything at time T0, everything was specified. You could tell what the model was going to look like at time T equals 1000. And the agents all knew that at time T equals 0, if you imposed rational expectations. And then because they realized, well, it's hard to get a lot of the real world outcomes that we want to focus on as economists and with that kind of a model, they introduced what they would call uncertainty, but they would just do, okay, so there's random variables that get realized every period. There's shocks to the economy, to technology and resource supplies and blah, blah, blah. And the agents, you know, they optimize knowing that, oh, I don't know what the value is going to be of that particular variable until it's realized next period. And so you can have regret in a certain sense, but it's sort of like if you're playing blackjack and you've got an 11 and the dealer's showing a 6 and it's a fresh deck and you double down and then you get a 2 and the dealer flips, you know, an ace. Well, you regret that you doubled down, but you still did the right thing given the information you had at the time. That's kind of the deal.
Right. Your behavior was still rational ex ante.
Right.
Yeah,
and so Kirzner
have a different view here.
Yeah, so Kirzner objects to that. He says they're just kind of pushing the rationality, perfect information back one level, and whereas Kirzner talks about sheer ignorance. He says you could just kick yourself, you know, that kind of thing. Like you didn't know what you didn't know, and then once you see it, you're upset, and you know. And he would say that like, you could just kick yourself. And so anyway, that's. But I think what the point is. That thing, even though he's got that, he sees the deficiency in the mainstream approach in terms of equilibrium. So even there, it's still an equilibrium always analysis. It's just they've incorporated the fact that there's random variables that get realized over time, and then the agents are only optimizing in an ex ante sense. But I think what you're saying, though, Peter, still is that still his the way he handles entrepreneurship per se doesn't. It's awkward at best in terms of incorporating that other element of his worldview.
Yeah, one other something to add to that is that Kirzner's entrepreneur, you know, this very abstract notion also doesn't own any capital, doesn't own any resources, but just kind of recognize and profits from these discovery opportunities, you know, costlessly picking up the $20 bill on the ground. I much prefer a view in which the entrepreneur is modeled as a resource owner. And I like the kind of Misesian, Rothbardian interpretation that I've tried to elaborate in my own work, in which, you know, entrepreneurship in the sort of commercial sense is the acquisition and combination and deployment of valuable productive resources in pursuit of economic profits, resources that you might lose, right? I mean, that's what it means to earn a loss. You can actually, the value of your capital stock can go down. You can end up losing these valuable resources. And so that's where the prospect of loss comes from. But I very much like the idea of even a formal construct of entrepreneurship that sees the entrepreneur as a very active, not a passive agent who just sits back and waits for things to discover, but an agent who is acting in the world of uncertainty, trying to make things happen, trying to start new businesses, trying to introduce new products, trying to maintain existing activities in the face of uncertainty, you know, to try to produce goods and services that consumers want and better than other entrepreneurs. So I like the connection in my view of entrepreneurship between the entrepreneur and resources and capital. I think that's a nice way to incorporate other aspects of the Austrian tradition, like Austrian capital theory, into applied studies of companies and entrepreneurs.
Yeah, let me just elaborate again, because I know what you're talking about here, and just for people who aren't right. So the way Kirzner's looking at it, the entrepreneur is a purely functional analysis. And so what is it that labor or the workers do? They sell labor in exchange for wages. And that's a very definite thing. You know how many labor hours you're selling. You know what the wage rate is. You know what you're getting paid. End of story. There's no uncertainty there in terms of that transaction. Now, you know, you could have decided maybe I wanted to go to another industry and maybe I should have gone to night school and gotten certified and become a mechanic or something. And so, that's entrepreneurial. But in terms of your role as a wage earner, labor as such, you know, that's the transaction. Same thing with resource, natural resources. You hire farmland or something. You buy some iron ore or whatever from an owner. That's you pay the market price, and that's it. And the returns are due to the marginal productivity of those factors. And then even with capital, if you're paying just the market rate of interest, then what the capitalist is earning is just a return based on time preference and the passage of time. And so what is it the entrepreneur does, as you say, he's combining all those elements, all those factor inputs, and it's the entrepreneur who's kind of above it all and has the plan to take those inputs, combine them into something and sell it. And if he has alertness, then he earns the return, the pure profit. And that's what the pure profit is. That's the specific return to the entrepreneur as such, not any of those other things. And so the problem with that is, and I think Rothbard pointed this out, I don't know if he was the first, is, the capitalist who's lending the money, he has to be the one then to decide, is this a good venture or not?
Yeah, that's
because,
right. Yeah,
because the entrepreneur could just be crazy. You know, he could just say some really grandiose thing that's nutty. And so it's really not true that the capitalist can be guaranteed, the market rate of return. And this contract says, if I lend you $1 million, you're going to pay me back, you know, $1 million, my principal plus 5% interest next year. And that's the going rate of return. And then if you earn a profit, then you have more left over. That no, if there's a complete loss, maybe the entrepreneur doesn't have $1 million to make me whole. And so really it's the capitalist who's in a sense acting entrepreneurially, that's a tough adverb there as well. And so Okay.
You're exactly right. That's exactly the way I put it. I do want to clarify that, you know, my conception of the entrepreneur, I regard also to be, you know, very precise and kind of functional in the same sense that Kirzner's is functional. It's just a different interpretation of what that function is. And on the connection between the capitalist and the entrepreneur, Kirzner has long argued that Mises treats these as separate analytical categories. But I think even Mises is not very clear on this point. There's one particular passage, I don't remember the page number because I'm not David Gordon, where Mises makes this distinction. But on the very same page, just a few sentences later, Mises essentially says that you can only do even an analytical separation between the capitalist and the entrepreneur in a world of no uncertainty. As soon as you introduce uncertainty into your theorizing, the capitalist is an entrepreneur and the entrepreneur must also be a capitalist. And so that's the kind of functional notion that is important to me. One other point that you made is important, that if you associate entrepreneurship as I do with resources and with ownership of resources, under uncertainty, you know, ownership is kind of it's the buck stops here function, right? So owners can always delegate decision authority to other people, to subordinates, just like in your example with the t-shirt shop. But the ultimate decision maker is not the college kid who's deciding which t-shirts to print, right? It's the owner of the enterprise who established the enterprise, who is responsible for keeping the enterprise going, who made the decision to hire or not to hire a college student, who made the decision to delegate that decision to a college student, and who can take all those decision rights away, right? So really what I'm interested in is not which individual in a particular business context is making every day-to-day decision, but who holds the kind of ultimate responsibility for making sure resources get used in particular ways. And that is not, you know, a salaried employee can never perform that function. A hired consultant or a contract worker can never perform that function. It's only the person who has the legal ownership title to the resource who can exercise this kind of ultimate responsibility. And under uncertainty, that's what I think entrepreneurship is really all about.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Okay, do you got time for one more question?
Absolutely, okay. Sure.
So why don't we end with this then? So I know, you know, to the limit extent I've dabbled in this stuff, that one of the issues I know Kirzner would say, or at least as of the last, you know, time I had been acquainted with his work on this, I don't know if he's revised his view since then, but would say, yeah, all these so-called entrepreneurship programs that are sprouting up at, you know, business schools around the country, they're really management training programs. You can't teach entrepreneurial alertness the way what I mean by that term. And so it's not something that could be taught. And what they're doing is teaching people how to come into an established firm and kind of be a manager and make, you know, good decisions and blah, blah, blah. But that's not entrepreneurship. You can't teach somebody how to go spot a new industry and start a new thing from scratch. You can't teach someone to see what they can't already see. So along those lines. So how do you, first of all, do you get what I'm talking about? And then how do you feel about that?
Certainly. So I have the same view, right? I mean, my view is that entrepreneurship, again, as I conceive it, this kind of judgmental decision-making under uncertainty, ultimately is not teachable. But I think, I don't like the question, can entrepreneurship be taught? Rather, I like a question what aspects of the entrepreneurial process are teachable? And I think some of them certainly are teachable, right? To be successful as a commercial entrepreneur, you need to know some basic, you know, accounting and finance and, you know, marketing techniques and so forth. It helps to have industry-specific knowledge, technical knowledge, and engineering knowledge, you know, to have access to statistics that are relevant to your particular industry or product that you're going into. It helps to have some knowledge of how to deal with other people, how to hire people, and how to supervise employees, how to deal with potential funders and so forth. So yeah, there are practical skills that are teachable, that are relevant and useful for the entrepreneur, and you can teach those things. That's not the same thing as teaching entrepreneurship. You can also, Bob, teach about entrepreneurship. You can have a kind of conversation like we're having now, sort of theoretically, what is the role of the entrepreneur in society, and empirically, how have entrepreneurs, you know, contributed to well-being or whatever. To me, I like to think of an analogy with the creative arts, with painting or music. Mm-hmm. You know, can music be taught? Well, I mean, yes, some aspects are teachable. You can teach music theory. You can teach, you know, technique, how to play an instrument. You can teach music history. Like, lots of college kids take a class in music appreciation. Why do people think Mozart was so great, even if you yourself don't appreciate Mozart? But of course, you know, you can take all of those courses. You can major in music. You can get a PhD in music and not be the next Mozart. And occasionally a Mozart will pop up who has no formal training in music whatsoever. But, you know, most of the natural geniuses have some sort of technical knowledge. So again, you can't teach somebody to be the next Steve Jobs, but I think we can teach aspects of the entrepreneurial process that are useful to people who might end up being the next Steve Jobs. And particularly important, I think everyone in society should have an understanding of what entrepreneurs do and why the entrepreneurial role is so important, so they won't, you know, muck it up, right? So they won't support bad policies that make it difficult for entrepreneurs to do what they do.
That's great. Yeah. Even as I asked and then you were answering, it occurred to me, you know, push to its logical. In other words, I always liked what I the Kirzner's talk, you know, answer on that. But it occurred to me that there's a certain sense in which, okay, well, then you can't teach someone how to discover something in physics either. You know what I mean? Like, you can't say, now remember, like, our current theories are wrong and the better theory is such and such. So right. Now we're going to teach you to go publish a paper. No, the idea is, yep, these are the limits. And if you come up with but obviously that would be too glib. That certainly you can imagine programs and there's a culture. There was a famous thing where Richard Feynman was in some South American, I think it was Brazil, but I might be wrong, where he spent some time there. And then he went and told the president or something after that. He said, yeah, your program will never produce any good physicists because the kids are brought up to just, you know, do what the textbook says and to revere their teachers and never question them. And you need to be, you know, have a challenge culture, you know, to put it in layman. So anyway, certainly you can imagine there's different institutional and cultural things you could do that would promote the next physicist coming along who makes a major discovery, even though, yeah, in a sense, you can't teach someone, how do I make a discovery in physics?
Yes, I think that's another great analogy.
Okay, well, I think I've kept you long enough here, Peter. Thank you for your time. So folks at home, again, all this stuff, the links I'll put here, are going to be for bobmurphyshow.com/23. And so thanks, Peter, for your time. And I think the folks got a lot out of this discussion.
Thanks, Bob. I've really enjoyed it.
We'll see you later, folks, and tune in next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. The podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.